Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Parents worldwide know the risks and fear that come with allowing their child to venture out into the world. Schools are supposed to offer parents a greater sense of security, and a lot of parents feel very few worries about their children heading to school each morning. However, in 2004, a shocking murder instilled fear in parents across the world and led to many questioning, is my child really safe in school? As well as, does my child really know their best friend? Fourteen-year-old Jamie Goff was a straight-A student at Southwood Middle School, which was located in an affluent neighbourhood in southwest Miami-Dade County. Southwood Middle School had been recognised as an A school for several years because of the performance of the students on standardised tests. The school was also home to a visual and performing arts magnet. Jamie was in 8th grade and played the violin. He lived in the Kendall area with his family. He had a younger sister who was 10 years old and absolutely adored animals, in particular turtles and snakes. As his cousin, Anna Amaya, said, he was a very good boy, a very good student, and he was very happy. A lot of fun. His father, George Goff, had immigrated to the United States from Panama, and he worked as a dockhand down at Grove Isle Marina. His mother, Maria, had come to South Florida from El Salvador. She had left her homeland at the height of its civil war, when her province was one of the most embattled. She worked alongside her husband at the marina, cleaning yachts and condominiums. The couple met when Maria was taking English lessons, and they hit it off immediately. Over the school holidays, Jamie could often be spotted down at the marina with his parents. Jamie was quite shy, but always friendly. He much preferred to be in the background than the centre of attention. Jamie Velez, whose son James was best friends with Jamie, said, he wasn't outspoken, but if you ever spoke to him, he was always polite. He often hung out at the house to play video games, and they used to do homework together. According to those who knew him best, Jamie loved playing on the computer, as well as the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Japanese swords. But he never liked to tell anybody about these interests, because he feared that his peers would make fun of him. In late 2003, Jamie and some of his friends joined a fitness program at the local YMCA. Jamie had confided in his friends that he wanted to trim some of his baby fat. Jamie was a keen student and had always earned top grades in school. In fact, he was scheduled to start high school in the fall of 2004 at one of the country's top magnet programs. He had been accepted to the prestigious international bachelorette program at Coral Gables Senior High. His parents said that he was very mature and respectful for his age and always listened to what his parents said. His father, George, said, he was a kid I could talk with, have fun with. It was the 3rd of February 2004 when students at Southwood Middle School were preparing for another day of education. At around 8:30 that morning, a group of children went into the school's bathroom. As soon as they entered, they spotted a puddle of blood and a pair of legs sticking out from underneath a bathroom stall. They ran to the school resource officer, who called 911. The person in the stall was identified as Jamie, and he was still clinging to life. Tragically, by the time paramedics arrived, Jamie was dead. And this was no tragic accident. he had been stabbed at least 40 times, mainly on the neck and face. Defensive wounds to his hands showed that Jamie desperately attempted to fend off his attacker, but to no avail. Police were called to the scene while school officials immediately imposed a lockdown and shut all of the students in their classrooms. The school was now an active crime scene and the killer had not been identified or apprehended. As news of the stabbing swept throughout the community, parents rushed to the scene but were ordered to stay away, much to their understandable anger. However, this was an active crime scene with a killer still on the loose. A lot of parents were frustrated and lambasted school officials as well as police for lack of information that was provided throughout the day. Police quickly told the parents that the situation was under control and that their children were safe, that the parents of the victim had already been informed. However, they hadn't allowed the pupils to use their cell phones to call their parents, which understandably left many of them worried and concerned for their well-being. After all, they were locked inside a school with a killer. Jamie's parents were informed right away and rushed to the scene where they were allowed to be with their son. Other members of his family spent much of the day at the crime scene tape surrounding the school. Jamie's parents were the only ones allowed in. His mother Maria collapsed at the scene and had to be sedated at hospital. One parent, Kathy Wood, said, "You send your kids off to school and you think they'll come back." At the end of the day, students began to trickle out of the school. Emotions were up in the air as children ran towards their parents, who were all still congregated at the crime scene tape outside the school. The lockdown at the school had ended at regular school dismissal time, 3:40 p.m., and none of the students had learned about the murder, although they knew that something had been amiss since they'd spent the entire day in one classroom. Staff had told students not to worry, that everything was fine. But of course rumours had already begun circulating. And when they left school that afternoon, they would finally learn that one of their classmates had been murdered in the school bathroom. That evening, it was announced that a 14-year-old student was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. The boy was not immediately identified due to his young age, but Miami-Dade Police Director Carlos Alvarez said that the two boys knew each other, but they were still trying to determine what led to the murder. While there was relief that the killer had been apprehended, parents were still reeling from how the situation was handled. At 7 p.m, hundreds of parents attended a meeting with police that was held at the school. Principal Crystal Hickmore broke down in tears as she thanked the parents for their patience, stating, "When all you wanted to do was hug and hold your child." Also in attendance at the meeting was a psychologist who informed parents that they would need to talk with their children about what had transpired and to not be surprised if their child had trouble coping with what had happened. According to one mother, her daughter had told her that a student with a bloodstained t-shirt was in her class until the middle of the day before being removed and was not brought back. The mother questioned why, and the police chief informed the mother that first of all, they had believed that Jamie's wounds may have been self-inflicted. The student with the bloodstained t-shirt turned out to be the student who was arrested and charged with the murder. School officials said that they would be providing counselling for all of the 28 students in that specific class. During the meeting, a lot of parents questioned the school's safety and asked why there were no metal detectors. The murder of Jamie completely paralysed the community and the surrounding area, even more so because it had taken place on school grounds, and a teenage boy was the victim with another teenage boy being the perpetrator. However, similar violent incidents had taken place around South Florida in the preceding months. Just 2 months earlier, a student was stabbed during an altercation at Palm Beach Gardens High School, and another student was facing an attempted murder charge. And in November of 2002, a football player had been stabbed to death near Piper High School. According to Joanne McDaniel, director of the Center for Prevention of School Violence in North Carolina, she wasn't surprised when she learned that the murder had taken place in middle school. She said that people erroneously assume that more violence occurs in high schools, but she said, oftentimes it's actually a situation where you have more violent criminal and disciplinary cases in middle school. She further stated that there are a lot of violent incidents in bathrooms and buses, and said that a number of schools lock bathrooms when there is no adult supervision. She said that the other schools use a buddy system, which means that no child goes to the bathroom alone. According to Southwood, they said that this was something they would strongly consider in the aftermath of Jamie's murder. The day after the murder, the killer would be identified as 14-year-old Michael Hernandez. Immediately, everybody suspected that the murder was the result of a bullying episode gone horrendously wrong. Sadly for Jamie, he had oftentimes been bullied in school because of his shy and quiet demeanor. However, it would be revealed that Michael was Jamie's best friend. And even more incomprehensible, he had planned the murder.
Mike, what's your birthday?
February 2nd, 1990.
Happy birthday. You just turned 14.
Yes, I did.
Very good. Today, who did you meet at the fence?
I met Jamie Hall.
Why did you try to get, why did you make the suggestion to Jamie to go inside the school today?
I was planning to marry.
How long have you had this plan?
A little under a week.
Following his arrest, Michael had told investigators that on the morning of the murder, he packed a serrated knife and latex gloves in his book bag. He said that his plan was simple, to murder his best friend. According to investigators, however, while Michael had confessed to the murder, he had not revealed a motivation. He had told investigators that the attack was completely planned, but totally unprovoked.
And is there any specific reason why you planned this?
No, there's not.
Why did you choose Jamie, your friend?
He was the easiest out of anybody because he would have followed me because we're such good friends. And I knew he would have followed me in there and done what I would have said.
During the confession, he described in chilling detail how he committed the murder.
I was going to get him into the stall, the last stall because it's the biggest, so I'd have more room. I got him into the stall by saying, look, I have something to show you. So I got him into the stall and I told him to turn around because I wanted to be a surprise. Before that, I put on the gloves. He saw me put on the gloves, and I said, all
right. Now, what transpired next?
Okay, I was talking to him, and I told him, all right, now I have to put my hand over your mouth.
Okay. Once you did that, what happened next?
I took the knife out, and I proceeded to slit his throat.
Did Jamie say or do anything? Did he put up a struggle?
Yes, he did. He turned around after I did that. He asked me not to kill him. So I told him, okay, I'm not going to cooperate.
Okay.
Which was a lie.
Right.
And so I realized that the stall door was open, so I locked it. And then I turned him around again and proceeded to stab him.
And where did you stab him, Mike?
I'm not positively sure, but I'm guessing around the jugular vein right around here.
Okay.
That's what I was aiming for.
Now, after you did that, what happened?
I left. I took my gloves off and I flushed them down the toilet. I put the knife. The knife was broken because of the stab wounds and I couldn't close it back. So I closed it as much as I could and I put it in my jacket pocket.
Okay.
I proceeded to go to the sink and I wiped some of the blood off the jacket, took the jacket off.
As the grim update was released in the media, Miami-Dade Police Director Carlos Alvarez said, "We didn't know how someone would commit such a horrific act, and we don't even know the reason why. Nothing had occurred between those two boys that would lead anyone to believe that there was a problem." According to those who knew Michael, he was a nice boy and always got good grades, much like Jamie. In fact, Michael was in the gifted program. When he was identified as the killer, his ex-girlfriend, Janice Lapler, said, "He was a nice guy. I never knew he was like that. You don't know who to trust anymore." Michael Villalba, who had known Michael since elementary school, said that he was laid back and funny, but said that over the years they weren't as close anymore because Michael had become better friends with Jamie. Another friend, Sarah Harrison, said that Michael was a kind boy and even got mad on one occasion when other children were burning ants. This description of Michael varied extensively with the boy that investigators had interviewed and the boy who made a full confession to the murder of his best friend. When he was removed from class, Michael had claimed that the blood on his shirt had come from a nosebleed. In his backpack, investigators found the murder weapon as well as bloodied gloves. Then while making the confession, investigators said that he showed no semblance of remorse for killing Jamie.
Let me ask you this. Is there any particular reason why you did this to Jamie?
No, there's not.
Did he offend you in any way? Think what you did is right or wrong?
No, I don't.
Well, what don't you think?
I think it is neither right, but I don't think it was wrong.
Do you know what you did is wrong?
Yes, I do.
Are you sorry that this happened today?
Oh, no.
Michael waived his first appearance in juvenile court, where prosecutors announced that they planned on seeking a grand jury indictment for first-degree murder due to the fact that Michael had confessed that he planned the murder, making it abundantly clear that this wasn't a spur-of-the-moment type murder. It was expected that Michael would be prosecuted as an adult, and if found guilty of murder, he could be sentenced to life without parole. The day after the murder, around 500 of the 1,800 students were absent from school. Those who did go to school spent the day in the library, where they spoke to counsellors and drew pictures and wrote letters for Jamie's family. They spoke about their confusion and fear over what had happened. That evening, a candlelight vigil was held in a field near the school's office. Principal Crystal Hickman said, "We have asked ourselves how this can be. We can't just let Jamie's death be in vain. Please let us stop pointing fingers at each other. Let's see what we can start doing now to make our students feel safer." Parents were still reeling from how the situation had been handled. However, national experts on school safety, as well as other area school police officials, said that correct protocol had been followed and the response was appropriate. James Kelly, Palm Beach County School's chief of police, said, "Nobody else got hurt. The lockdown stopped the suspect from getting away, and it gave them time to do an investigation. It's pretty quick to, in a matter of hours, detain the suspect in an unwitnessed crime." The stabbing was the 35th school-associated death, and that number had exceeded the number of deaths for the past two school years combined. In fact, it was higher than any other individual school year since the Columbine Massacre in 1999. A couple of days after the murder, Jamie's parents publicly spoke for the first time and expressed gratitude at the support they had received since his murder, and they pleaded with parents and students to prevent future violence in schools. George said, "All I could say to the kids out there, please, please, don't do these things because we're here to love each other and help each other, not here to take away someone's life." Maria called for better school security. Michael's family released a statement through a family friend. They said, "We'd like to express our deepest sympathy and condolences to Jamie's family. We have also lost our son and are trying to cope and understand what has happened." In an interview with the Herald, Michael's father, Manny, said that the murder was totally out of left field, that his son had never been in any kind of trouble, let alone something this horrific. Michael's family home showed nothing to explain Michael's actions. He had come from a close-knit family. Family portraits dotted the walls while Michael's bedroom was decorated with car posters, and in his bottom drawer he kept 11 Bibles. On another wall was a ceramic plaque which listed the Ten Commandments. On the 10th of February, Jimmy was laid to rest. Hundreds of people clambered in to the Caballero Woodlawn Funeral Home in southwest Miami-Dade County to pay their final respects. The sound of a single violin emanated throughout the church as a somber tribute to the boy who loved music. The student orchestra also played. Red flowers arranged in the shape of a violin sat behind Jimmy's casket. Letters addressed to Jimmy and two Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle figures were tucked into the casket to be buried with Jimmy. Jimmy had always feared that the other children would mock him for his love of the cartoon. But now, tragically, that didn't matter anymore. Jimmy was dressed in a dark suit and the collar was pulled high up on his neck to conceal his wounds. The pastor addressed Jimmy's family and said, "Jimmy too can live again. Georgia Maria, I know your hearts are heavy." George spoke of his son and said that he never wanted people to feel left out, especially his little sister Brenda. He said he had so much love and he wanted everyone to be loved. The murder of Jimmy renewed the debate on how children who commit murder should be treated and how they should be sentenced. Child welfare advocates say that children who commit serious crimes should not be treated or punished as adults because their brains are not fully developed and they think, act, and perceive the world differently than adults. Furthermore, there is the possibility that they can be rehabilitated. Stephen Harper, a public defender who once headed the juvenile division in Miami-Dade County, said, "I don't think it's appropriate to send children that young into the adult system, because studies show they are less competent and they are rehabilitable." When a child commits a serious crime, prosecutors will take into account a number of factors, including the juvenile's record, the severity of the crime, and the juvenile's age when deciding whether they should be tried as an adult. Many child advocates, as well as prison reformation advocates, say that the purpose of the penal system is to punish as well as to rehabilitate. But if the rehabilitation side is not allowed to be pursued, then the system is flawed. It would soon be announced that Michael would be prosecuted as an adult, which meant that if convicted, he would be facing a mandatory life sentence without the possibility of parole. The decision had been made by a grand jury, who had the details of the murder presented to them by prosecutors. Shortly after the announcement, a number of sources close to the investigation said that Michael had actually planned on killing a second student that day as well as Jimmy, but the second student did not come to school. They revealed that Michael had become obsessed with murder and had been studying methods of murder. His two targets were Jimmy and Andre Martin, another friend. One police source said, "He planned this all out. This was his step-by-step plan. He's smart, smarter than people know, and he targeted those kids." Towards the end of February, Michael pleaded not guilty to the murder of Jimmy. The judge said that Michael's parents were too wealthy for him to be appointed a public defender. His parents, Kathy and Manny, were told that they needed to find a private lawyer to defend their son. They had assets totaling at least $245,000. Most of the assets came from a retirement savings account and equity in their home, which was valued at almost $125,000. Manny ran a resale shop which brought in between $800 to $2,000 a month, while Kathy worked as an occupational therapist, earning around $2,600 a month. Many local lawyers in the area had informed the family that it could cost as much as $100,000 just to take on the case. In early March, Michael's parents hired the attorney who had won Lionel Tate his release from prison just the month before the murder. Lionel Tate was 13 years old. He was sentenced to life in prison for killing a 6-year-old. His attorney, Richard Rosenbaum, filed a notice of appearance in court. He said, "I'm representing him and looking forward to doing the best job we can do on this case." His first decision was to request the judge to bar the public from Michael's pre-trial hearings and to prevent the release of court records and Michael's videotape confession. He argued that Michael could not get a fair trial if these materials were released and court proceedings were reported in the media. Under Florida law, most pre-trial evidence in a criminal case is available for public scrutiny. The judge would ultimately deny his request. Shortly thereafter, prosecutors revealed more information in the case. A journal kept by Michael was made public. The journal contained violent obsessions as well as fixations on prayer and regular teenage problems such as acne and homework. The pages highlighted Michael's problems and his preoccupation with death, perfection, and lists. Michael had written a list of serial killers, and underneath he wrote, "Will become a serial killer." He compiled lists of violent video games and movies, as well as instructions for making Molotovs and explosives. Michael, who was Hispanic, wrote "white power" underneath a swastika on another page. He also had a to-do list which reminded him to work out, read the Bible, worship God, pray, learn to draw, and switch pens every 2 weeks. On another page, he wrote that he wanted to learn how to become a pimp. There was a page that contained short phrases and thoughts. It read, "Carve cross, take right eye, leave note, stay alone, never forget God ever, have a cult and plan a mass kidnapping for a new world. Be an expert thief." The final 10 pages of his journal resembled unfinished lists, with titles such as weapons, body counts, names, and what was done. The release of the journal finally offered some insight into Michael's mind. Leonard Heber, a forensic psychologist who had testified during many child murder cases, said that the journal appeared to be the work of an angry and deeply disturbed boy who was obsessed with perfectionism and death. The final 2 pages of Michael's journal would be publicly released shortly thereafter, and they revealed that in addition to Jamie and Andre, Michael had another name on his hit list, his older sister. He had also written down his weapon of choice, a military-style switchblade that his father had given him. Michael had given no indication in the journal why he wanted to murder his older sister, who was 19 years old and a college student. It was further revealed that Michael had told investigators that he had planned on carrying out the murder of Jamie and Andre on the same day. He told the investigators that he had planned on strangling Andre in the bathroom and then stabbing him just to make sure that he was dead. However, his plan had failed when Andre refused to go into the bathroom stall with Michael.
"Me, Andre, Jamie, and myself were in the bathroom."
"How old is Andre?"
"He is 13.
"What grade is Andre in?"
"He's in 8th grade."
"Is he a friend of yours?"
"Yes, he is. I was going to strangle him first, and then after he was dead, I was going to make sure by stabbing him."
"Okay, and this was Andre?"
"This was Andre."
"Now, did you lure him into the bathroom yesterday?"
"Into the bathroom, yes, not the stall. I told them both that we were going to be late to class. And so we snuck upstairs after the late bell had rung. He got to the bathroom, and I was trying to convince Andre to go into the stall."
"And what? How were you going to do that?"
I told him that I had something to show him. His response, he didn't want to do it, so he said no. He's like, why can't Jamie go first? My response then was that he's going to go next."
"Okay. Now, did Jamie agree? Did Jamie say, I'll come in, I'll look?"
"Yes, he did."
"Okay. And what did you say at that point?"
"I said, no, he's going to go first."
"And any particular reason why?"
"I wanted to get Andre killed first. I said, okay, are you going to guys cooperate tomorrow?" They're like, yeah, okay, we'll cooperate tomorrow.
"All right. And you went off to class?"
"Yes."
"What were your intentions today?"
"I would have talked him into coming to the bathroom with me, coming into the stall. Then I would have proceeded to slit his throat and stab him continuously until he died."
"Yes."
"And then I would have left him there."
"Yes."
"And gone back downstairs and talked Jamie into coming upstairs. Lured him into the other bathroom."
"Okay.
and
slit his throat and stabbed him to death.
Michael had written a step-by-step plan in his journal, which read, lead A to the bathroom. Make his corpse sit on the toilet. This will be done early. Follow number one, but with Jamie. Follow number two, but with Jamie's corpse. Take off hat, gloves, tape, and jacket, and put into book bag. Put knife in the back opening. Make sure they are dead. Make sure there is no one else in the bathroom. If so, kill them. The final item on his list was, thank God for success. The writings in Michael's journal were completely polarized. A number of entries were regular thoughts and worries of a teenage boy. One entry read, my goals for this school year are simple. I just want to get good grades and learn as much as I can. Also to try and make a good impression on my teachers so I get good recommendations for high school. I want to absorb as much knowledge so I can seem intelligent when I have a conversation or anything else. He also wrote, the worst thing people can do to each other is lie. Some say that lying sometimes isn't always bad, but lying is bad no matter what. Lying is never good to do because people get hurt unnecessarily. Following the release of the journal, the judge ordered two doctors to conduct a psychological examination of Michael to determine competency. Defense Rosenbaum had proposed examinations by any three of the nationally known juvenile competency experts, but prosecutor Karen Kagan said that they were too expensive, adding that there was nothing to indicate that they needed to go to a national level expert to evaluate competency. With the psychological examination underway, more court papers were publicly released, which revealed that the other student, who Michael had planned on murdering, had told investigators that Michael had looked on websites that gave instructions on how to injure and incapacitate people. Michael had asked him whether he could demonstrate a technique he had learned in which he would place his thumb at the base of his neck. The boy said no to Michael. In early May, Defense Rosenbaum warned the judge that a delayed trial could make the jury less sympathetic towards Michael. He said that if Michael matured too much before the case went to trial, then the jury may struggle seeing him as the slight eighth grader he was at the time of the murder. He said, I want to try this case before he gets too old. I don't want him to be 6 feet tall in front of a jury. Michael's defense also tried to get Michael's confession thrown out, saying that his parents were barred from the interview and he had no attorney present. The judge would decide on that at a later time. Following the hearing, Kathy and Manny once again spoke with the media. They said that they had been shown their son's journal, and when they saw the violent writings, it was the first tangible glimpse they had of a Michael that they had no idea existed. They wanted to let people know that their son was not a monster, but was just a child. They said that he called home every day from the Dade County Jail, and they visited him twice a week. Kathy said, he's just flat. He's just not the same child that we knew. If he did this, it speaks of a very disturbed mind that we don't know. This is not the Michael we knew. They briefly spoke about their daughter, Christina, who was on Michael's hit list, and said that their relationship was normal, and said that they had even fought over who was going to say the blessing at night, but it was a regular brother-sister relationship. They said that everybody was wondering whether they had seen signs that their son was troubled, but they said they had never seen any evidence that anything was amiss. However, shortly thereafter, it was revealed that in the days after Michael was charged with murder, Manny and Kathy had said that they had noticed a change in their son, beginning in the summer and accelerating through December. They said that they had become worried about some strange perks that were becoming more pronounced in Michael. They said that his exercise regimen had become extreme, and it was one of the only things he did after school. They also noticed behaviour that appeared obsessive-compulsive and repetitive. Kathy described how Michael would open the fridge at the same time each day and look side to side, over and over again, as if he were counting the items in the fridge. She also said that he would stand in front of the grandfather clock for ages, and would open and close the garage door numerous times. She said he would do each of these things the same time each day after dinner. Kathy had spoken with Michael about seeing a therapist, but he wasn't willing to go. The normally inquisitive boy stopped having friends over and stopped the family routine of watching baseball together. He stopped shooting hoops in the driveway and stopped going for lunch each Sunday at Popeyes. His obsession with bodybuilding became extreme. He made lists of exercise routines and checked them off when completed. He even started to take whey protein in a bid to bulk up. In fact, he had even persuaded his parents to buy him a 2-pound can of the muscle-boosting supplement, creatine. While Michael's behaviour was certainly peculiar, there was just no way his parents could have foreshadowed what he would go on to do. They now worried that the creatine could have caused something in Michael to snap. While creatine was a popular supplement, there had been no studies in children, or beyond recommended doses. When they checked how much he had taken, he may have taken more than a pound of the supplement in just over a month, which was 3 or 4 times the recommended daily allowance for an adult. As it would be discovered, these weren't the only warning signs that something sinister may have been brewing within Michael. Kathy had seen 3 scratches on Michael's upper arm and had worried that they were self-inflicted. Then in November, Michael had jabbed a screwdriver at students during a football game, but this wasn't reported until after Jamie's murder. According to a classmate, Michael had downloaded photos of severed heads. In mid-June, it was announced that Michael was competent to stand trial by the 2 court-appointed doctors. Defence Rosenbaum said that he was shocked by the conclusions and said that it was his belief that Michael was mentally ill and not competent for trial. He also disclosed that he was considering pursuing an insanity defence for Michael. Just days later, Michael and Defence Rosenbaum were back in court, where Rosenbaum said that his 2 psychological experts concluded that Michael was not competent to stand trial. He submitted their competency evaluations to the judge, who ordered a hearing on the controversial issue. Shortly thereafter, Michael was additionally charged with plotting to kill Andre. Michael's defence attorneys, as well as his mother and her lawyer, called the new charge piling on and said that it was a way to break down the family financially and emotionally. Kathy said, "The judicial system is about money. We are working, middle-class people." Towards the end of August, Michael's defence argued that taxpayers should help to pay for his defence. The judge had earlier refused to declare Michael or his family poor enough to qualify to have the state pick up part of his legal bills. Kathy testified that she and Manny had taken out a $90,000 equity loan against their home. They had already paid Defence Rosenbaum $65,000 in legal fees, and their only other significant assets were their retirement fund. Defence Rosenbaum wanted the judge to approve using state money for costs other than his legal fees, and he had tallied up $20,000 in costs so far. In November, the competency hearing was held, and mental health experts disagreed on whether Michael was competent. 2 court-appointed experts testified that Michael most likely suffered from mental illness, mainly depression and obsessive-compulsive disorder. Despite this, they believed that Michael's thinking patterns were rational enough that he could understand the legal system and assist in his own defence. A defence expert, however, said that he believed that Michael suffered from schizophrenia and that his thinking was so disordered that he was not competent to stand trial. Defence Rosenbaum then revealed that Michael may have had a growth on his brain which could affect his defence. Michael was ordered to undergo a neurological test. Shortly thereafter, Michael was determined competent to stand trial as an adult on first-degree murder charges. The judge wrote in his ruling The court finds, based on review of the file and the testimony of the witnesses, that the defendant has a mental illness. However, the mental illness does not impact on the defendant's competency to proceed with trial. In January, Defence Rosenbaum filed court papers invoking an insanity defence. Wanting a successful insanity defence is not an easy feat. The defendant must be more than mentally ill. The defence needs to prove that their client did not know at the time that his actions were wrong. Shortly after the filing, it was the one-year anniversary to Jamie's murder. To commemorate his life, his family released butterflies outside Southwood Middle School during a ceremony. They said that Jamie had always loved butterflies and had once told his father the reason. Because they only live a short time, but they're beautiful and happy. The school sang Imagine by John Lennon while a rabbi and minister offered words of encouragement to other students. A couple of months later, it was announced that Judge Henry, late Vidal, declared Michael indigent, and it was ordered that Florida taxpayers would be footing his legal bills. By this point in the case, Michael's parents had spent more than $115,000 in attorney fees and costs. Following the decision, Attorney Rosenbaum announced that he wanted to look through Jamie's computer because he believed that there may be evidence that Jamie had contemplated suicide before he was murdered. He also said that there may have been evidence that Michael and Jamie had engaged in role-playing games and fantasized about being the perpetrators of the Columbine Massacre. Prosecutors strongly refuted this and said that an investigation of the computer revealed no such evidence. Greg Schwartz, an attorney for Maria and George, expressed anger at Defense Rosenbaum's request, stating, "What does any of this have to do with an insanity defense in which you have a kid saying, 'I did it, I confess'? It's a shame they have to drag the victim's name when the only issue here is if Michael Hernandez was sane or not." With the case still making its way through the justice system, it was revealed that Maria and George could receive as much as $1.7 million from the Miami-Dade School District in a settlement approved by the school board. They had sued the district for wrongful death, asking for $5 million. In agreeing to the settlement, Superintendent Rudy Crew said, "While no legal settlement can ever bring full closure to such a tragedy, this agreement with the Goff family is a fair and reasonable resolution to this painful incident." Today's sponsor is shapeandfoster.com. It is a lifestyle development app that provides monthly actionable insight from six experts in mental health, financial planning, nutrition, fitness, yoga, and a life coach. All members are on Shape and Foster for the same reason, to learn and grow. This makes for an active and positive community, and one you should be part of. It is a one-stop shop for self-improvement. The app provides a proactive and informed approach to improving your mental well-being by enabling practices and habits to be built. Lifestyle development is about enhancing your quality of life by improving awareness, identity, and potential. For me personally, my favorite part of the app is the live yoga classes, which I've been taking part in weekly. The app is super simple to use and the interface is really straightforward. So head on over to shapeandfoster.com for your free 14-day trial and learn from six pillars essential to a healthy heart and healthy mind in one unique app. That is shapeandfoster.com for your free 14-day trial. As a true crime podcast fan and author, sometimes I need a little break from all of the negativity and something to take the edge off. What better than a mobile puzzle game filled with cute characters? I'm sure you've already heard of Best Fiends. There's over 100 million global downloads, and it truly seems like everybody is playing it. And I think that you should be playing it too. They've even sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. As you progress through the game, you collect cute little monsters that you can evolve as you make your way through the levels. Best Fiends is easy to follow and fun to play, making it the perfect game for both adults and children. It's a casual game that won't stress you out, and it's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it mostly before bed, and I'm already on level 241. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Marie and George would be in court shortly thereafter for the taped confession of Michael to be played out. After describing stabbing Jamie, Detective Salvatore Gaffalo said, "How did you know he was dead?" To which Michael replied, "I made sure by taking my knife and poking him in the face, and I checked his eyes also." He told the detective he had slashed Jamie's throat from left to right and said that there was blood coming from his mouth to the right of the toilet, and there was blood on the walls. It was revealed during his pre-trial hearing that, first of all, Michael didn't confess. He had claimed that the blood on his shirt had come from a nosebleed, that Jamie could have been killed because he owed someone money, and in another version of events, he said that a non-existent child named Sangre had asked him to lure Jamie to the bathroom and then hold him while Sangre killed him. Eventually, Michael admitted that Sangre was made up. And when asked why he had named the imaginary child Sangre, he replied, "Because I said he was Hispanic, and I said he was part of a gang. And Sangre, in Spanish, means blood, so I thought that would be a decent gang name." He said that he had picked Jamie because he was one of his best friends and would have followed him to the bathroom if asked. When the detective asked Michael if he knew what he had done was wrong, he said that he did. Defense Rosenbaum was trying to get the confession thrown out as evidence, but the judge would ultimately deny the motion, and the confession was able to be used during trial. In May of 2008, as the murder trial was fast approaching, Michael was offered a plea deal. He was asked if he would plead guilty to a reduced charge and serve a 50-year prison sentence. Michael turned the plea down. Judge Schlesinger said to Michael, "In Florida, life means life. If you go to prison for life, you come out in a box." Attorney Rosenbaum said that Michael would be willing to plead guilty in exchange for a 25-year prison sentence. But this was rejected by the prosecution because it was much too lenient for the gravity of the crime. The trial was then pushed back to September, and it was decided that the case would be moved from Miami to Orlando due to the relentless media coverage. Trial began on the 11th of September. During opening statements, Defense Rosenbaum laid out an insanity defense, stating that his client was obsessed with serial killers, gangs, and violence. He admitted that his client had killed Jamie. He said that Michael was mentally ill, that his mind had started spiraling down, and that he was not thinking like a normal child. He said that he had developed this idea that his role in life was to become a serial killer. He said he wanted to kill everyone in the world. He wanted to kill everyone in the world and on the space station. He said that he would be presenting expert witnesses who would agree that Michael was mentally ill. State Attorney Kagan, on the other hand, described that Michael's actions were methodical, not insane. Speaking of the crime scene, she said, "His life was literally ebbing away with the blood that was cascading from him onto the bathroom floor until he died alone." Early testimony in the trial focused on the crime scene inside the school. Roman Nelson, a school security guard, was the first to take the witness stand. He broke down in tears as he described finding Jamie covered in blood, perched over the toilet. He was so overcome with emotion as he described the scene that a brief recess had to be called. Tracy Pysant, a Miami-Dade school police officer, next testified. She said, "He was lying in a pool of blood. She choked back tears as she described how Jamie's fleece jacket was saturated in blood. As she testified, jurors were shown crime scene photos. Her testimony would be followed by three teenagers, two of whom were in Michael's class, and one who found Jamie. Brian Gonzalez said that when he found Jamie, he was still clinging to life and was trying to breathe. Andre Martin, the second friend on Michael's hit list, was also called to testify. He said that throughout middle school, Michael had idolized killers from horror movies and said that it would be cool to be a serial killer one day. He said that when Michael's behavior changed, he confided in him and Jamie that he believed that he was mentally ill, stating that he believed that he had schizophrenia and obsessive compulsive disorder. He said that on the 2nd of February, Michael had tried to lure him to the bathroom. He said that he had something to show him in the handicapped stall, but Andre became too concerned and told Michael he should show him in the main stall. At the time, Jamie was standing watch. He even suggested he show Jamie first. He said that the whole situation seemed off. He said he thought it was strange that Michael was wearing a red jacket and baseball cap while standing outside the stall, trying to lure them in. Michael kept trying to persuade Andre to come into the stall, but then the bell rang. The three boys agreed that they would meet there again the following morning. But this time, Andre wasn't there, just Jamie. He told the jury that it was a miracle, a blessing from God, that he was spared. The confession tape would then be played out. During the confession, Michael had asked the detective what it was that had led to him being suspected, if it was the latex glove he had taken off. Attorney Rosenbaum had asked the detective who conducted the interview why it took them hours to let Michael's parents know that he was being questioned. He said that Michael had waived his right to an attorney, had voluntarily gone with police to the headquarters, and had never asked to contact his parents. Florida law does not bar police from questioning a minor without their parents present. Manny, Michael's father, was called to testify. He described how his son, who was a good child and a little league baseball player, turned into an emotionless loner and compulsive health fanatic. He said that when Michael turned 13, he began to notice a change in his son. He didn't want to go to dinner with them on the weekends or go to auctions with him like he used to do in the past. He said that he stopped making eye contact and just wanted to stay in his bedroom. When Kathy testified, she painted a very similar portrait of her son. She said that he had enjoyed collecting toy cars and Beanie Babies before changing in the 7th grade. She spoke of his obsessive compulsive actions, such as standing in front of the clock at the same time and rearranging the knives on the dinner table so they all faced him. She told the jury that when she was brought in to her son in the police conference room, she was shocked by his appearance. She said, "I saw nothing in his face. I saw no emotions. I saw nothing in his eyes. I saw nothing that was the Michael that I knew, and he's still not the same." She became emotional as she recollected the first time she had met Jamie. She had told Michael that she liked his friend, and Michael said, "I knew you would." Both Kathy and Manny believed that their son was mentally ill and insane on the day he murdered Jamie. A defense expert would testify next. Dr. Barry Rosenfeld, a forensic psychologist, testified that he had diagnosed Michael with paranoid schizophrenia, adding that he was psychotic and out of touch with reality when he killed Jamie. He reached his diagnosis after interviewing Michael for more than 20 hours over the past 4 years. She said that his journal was evidence that he was mentally ill. During cross-examination, Prosecutor Kagan said that even if Michael was mentally ill, he didn't meet Florida's legal definition of insane. She said that evidence showed that Michael knew that what he was doing was wrong and had methodically planned the murder. Dr. Rosenfeld responded that he did not believe that Michael comprehended the consequences of his actions, to which the prosecution shot back. He understood the consequences of his actions would be that his best friend would be dead, didn't he? To which the doctor replied, Yes. According to Dr. Rosenfeld, Michael's descent into mental illness picked up speed around Thanksgiving time. He said that he needed to be asleep by 10:30, and that if he hadn't fallen asleep in 10 minutes, he would self-harm as a punishment. He said that Michael decided his odd behaviour meant that he was training to be a serial killer, and his ultimate plan was to kill everybody in the world by the time he was 30. Prosecution expert Dr. John Shaw would refute this. He testified that Michael had some mental problems but was not legally insane at the time of the stabbing. He said that Michael never heard voices, became disconnected from reality, or appeared disorganized in his thoughts and speech, which were symptoms of paranoid schizophrenia. He said that Michael didn't suffer from delusions, but just an active imagination. He said that fantasy should not be confused with delusions. Furthermore, he said that Michael's successful performance in school and a lack of problems at home showed that he was functioning too well to be considered legally insane. In closing arguments, State Attorney Kagan once again reiterated the prosecution's argument that Michael had planned the murder well in advance and had gone to great lengths to cover it up. She reminded the jury that Michael wore gloves to make sure he didn't leave fingerprints and wore a jacket and cap, which he could then dispose of and made up a lie when questioned by police. Turning to the jury, she stated, "We will ask you to hold him responsible for each drop of Jamie's blood spattered in that bathroom stall." In his closing arguments, Defence Rosenbaum urged the jury to rule Michael not guilty by reason of insanity. He said, "It's quite evident from the written words in Michael's journal that he was delusional. He didn't know the consequences of what he was doing when he set out to kill everyone on Earth and in the space station." Following the closing arguments, the jury were sent away to deliberate. There was no denying that Michael had killed Jamie, but was he legally insane at the time? After 3.5 hours of deliberation, the jury reached a verdict. They found Michael Hernandez guilty of the murder of Jamie Goff. As the verdict was read out, Michael showed no emotion. George and Maria cried and hugged one another. Shortly after the verdict was handed down, Michael would be back in court to be sentenced. The judge imposed a mandatory sentence under Florida law, which was life in prison without the possibility of parole. He was also sentenced to a further 30 years for attempting to murder Andre, who he had lured to the bathroom stall the day beforehand. While handing down the sentence, the judge told Michael that he had caused a parent's worst nightmare by killing a fellow youngster who was his best friend. Jamie's family were given the opportunity to provide an impact statement. George said that he had forgiven Michael. He looked him in the eyes and said,
"You took his life. Why, Michael? Why? He was your friend, Michael. He was your friend."
Michael glanced occasionally at George, but declined to reply. In 2015, Michael was back in court where his life sentence was to be reconsidered. The US Supreme Court had banned automatic life sentences without the possibility of parole for minors who were convicted of murder, which meant that all of the sentences needed to be reconsidered. Maria and George wrote a letter to the judge stating that they believed that Michael's sentence should remain the same and that he was a threat to society. Michael apologized for the first time and claimed that he had gained control over the violent thoughts that led to Jamie's murder.
"I had to learn over years how wrong it was what I did and how much pain I caused you. I'm sorry. It hurts me how senseless it was, because he was always such a good friend to me."
Prosecutor Gail Levine accused Michael of expressing false remorse, stating, "As you sit here today, you cry on cue. That's what you do." She informed Michael that she had access to his phone calls from inside prison with his girlfriend.
"So, I think I told you last time that, because, you know, I'm supposed to be going out for my resentencing in August. It just seems like such a needless formality that put me through another psychological interview. I've been interviewed by so many psychologists, psychiatrists over the years. It's ridiculous. And, you know... What more do you want from me? My judge, who happens to be a former prosecutor, is totally on the state side. It was really bad. He's a piece of...
Girl, why don't you practice your weekend learning how to cry?
Oh, my God. God, man, I may have to stab myself.
Oh, my God.
I better bring a sharp object to the interview. Mm-hmm. Do you have something in your hand, Mr. Hernandez? No. Stab. Oh, see, I can cry.
I'm human, I swear. Look at these tears.
When I have life-threatening wounds, I can cry.
Oh, Lordy.
The phone calls were extremely disturbing, to say the very least, and showed that Michael evidently had zero remorse for what he had done. Prosecutor Levine wasted no time in grilling Michael on the witness stand.
Got a paperclip in there?
Ma'am.
Got a knife?
No, ma'am.
How'd you muster up those tears?
I feel horrible about what I did.
The remorse you show because you think, quote, the judge is a piece of... Right?
No, ma'am, I don't think that.
You said that, though, right?
I did say it, and it was a horrible, stupid thing to say.
What was stupid was you didn't think that I was smart enough to listen to your calls.
The judge would once again sentence Michael to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
I'm compelled to reach a conclusion that I never wanted to reach. And that conclusion is that the defendant, Michael Hernandez, today is essentially the same kind of person he was in 2004. Accordingly, the court adjudicates the defendant guilty of the first-degree murder of Jamie Goff and sentences him to life in prison.
No parent on this earth expects that their child will go to school one morning and not return home. No parent on this earth expects their child to leave school in a body bag or in the back of a police car, charged with the murder of their best friend. In the space of just a few minutes, the lives of two tight-knit, average families were forever changed by unimaginable violence. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Laura Parisi, Rosalie Jean, Anna Green, Beck Fullwood, and Rebecca Hicks. Morbidology is a one-woman team, and the support on Patreon truly goes such a long way. It helps to defray the cost of freedom of information requests, which make Morbidology episodes what they are, archive subscriptions, hosting, and much more. In return for your support on Patreon, you'll get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular platforms, early release episodes, ad-free episodes, true crime articles, and you can request any case for me to cover on the podcast. You can join for as little as $1 a month. There are no obligations, and you can cancel any time. You can also sign up annually to get 15% off. Big thanks to everybody who has simply listened to an episode as well. The support is very much appreciated. As I'm sure you're all aware, I have a new investigative podcast series called The Shattered Window. It's a 10-part podcast about the unsolved murder of Jacqueline DeWallaby, as well as a wrongful conviction. So head on over to wherever you're listening to this episode and subscribe to The Shattered Window. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Murder in the Rain. Till next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Calling all true crime fans, murderinos, crime junkies, and wine coven members. Have you listened to Murder in the Rain yet?
Murder in the Rain is a true crime podcast based in the Pacific Northwest, focused on the local cases that make us the notorious home of bizarre crimes and serial killers.
I'm your host, Alicia Holland.
And I'm your host, Emily Rowney.
I'm Josh. I forgot.
In each episode, we will cover a case to bring you all the details of the crime, We often feature interviews with people close to the cases, including authors, victims, doctors, and detectives.
Most content is dark and not suitable for young or sensitive listeners, but we do try to lighten the mood by providing a blooper reel at the end of every single episode. Trust me, you'll love it.
Check us out today, and if you like us, don't forget to subscribe, follow us on social media, and leave us a review.
Our website, murderintherain.com, has additional content, podcast feeds, discount codes to some of our sponsors, and an interactive map with locations for each episode.